Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that I have written and tell you how to access them. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mention those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of 1 Samuel. We've come to 1 Samuel chapter 23. In the narratives, David, the future king of Israel, upon whom is the hand of God, is in flight for his life from King Saul, from whom the hand of God has been withdrawn, in murdering the house of Ahimelech, the man who once would not put to death Agag, the king of the Amalekites, whom God had ordered him to destroy, has shredded the last vestige of human conscience, and he's gone from being just intermittently moody to being mostly mad and using pious excuses to engage in perversity. David, meanwhile, is being trained by all these experiences to be a leader, to be a soldier, and to deal with all kinds of people. He is surrounded by the broken, the bankrupt, the bitter. Those are the people that God has given him. And if he can learn to deal with them, he can learn to deal with anybody. Well, we read in verse 23, then they told David, just as Saul had his intelligence network, David had developed his. His spies told him, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah and are plundering the threshing floors. David was very concerned about his people, even as he was concerned about the intrigues of Saul against his life. And so he was torn. He could expose himself by coming out of hiding and taking up the cause of the people at Keilah. David showed himself very wise, and this was what made David David in part. So David inquired of the Lord, so different from Saul, who was impetuous and would do his thing first and ask God later, shall I go and attack these Philistines? The Lord said to David, yes, go and attack the Philistines. But then David ran into a problem. Consider the people that he's dealing with. Though they are David's army, they are outcasts. They are the disenfranchised. They are people who are burdened. They are people who are disillusioned. They are people who are broken, who are bitter. And David is himself an outcast. So they have that point of affinity with him. But this is not the godliest crowd that he's been surrounded by. So all of a sudden, they are kind of in David's face. they fear that David is biting off more than he can chew. So David's men said to him, "Sir, behold, we're afraid here in Judah. Saul's spies are all around. We could be attacked without warning at any time. How much more if we go to Keilah against the ranks of the Philistines? I mean, that too is a formidable force." Well, then David shows an extra measure of wisdom here. He double checks his leading. Then David inquired of the Lord once more, and the Lord answered him and reaffirmed his will. "Arise, go up to Keilah, and I will give the Philistines into your hand." The Lord gave him a warranty of victory in his assault upon the Philistines. So David and his men went to Keilah, and they fought with the Philistines, and they were very successful. He led away their livestock, and he struck them with a great slaughter. Thus David delivered these people from the Philistine threat. This was God's work. When I think of those who were questioning David's leadership in this military adventure, I think of many men who go out and take churches, as I did coming out of seminary, and you certainly don't have the best material to work with. Some of these little churches that men go into when they get out of school, if they don't go onto a church staff somewhere, are what I call rock garden churches. They're kind of trainers for young pilots. You can't do the church as much damage. They've suffered about all the damage that they can endure, but they can learn a lot. And David is in a training position here. He's not surrounded by the best of the best. That day will come, more or less, but he's got a fighting force, and he's whipping them into fighting shape, and the Lord is giving them that training. But as spiritual allies, they are not people of the same metal. They are not people of the same temper. I remember when I took my first church right out of seminary back in my native state of West Virginia. I always said it was a very strange town. It was a little town of about 900 people, about 17 miles northwest of the state capital. A lot has changed there in that little village since then. My wife and I, years later, used to mentally run up and down the streets. There weren't a lot of them. Our minds searching for one, really, what we thought of as normal family, just normal people. I don't mean they were all bad people, but they were so often irregular people. And we had trouble coming up with people who weren't really seriously damaged goods in many ways. And so that was reflected to a great extent even in our church at that time. I don't mean everybody was in that mode. But I can say that the church was, to a great extent, in the minds of the people, kind of like a Masonic lodge. You don't hear a lot about that out here on the West Coast, but there it was kind of a big deal, Masonic Lodge and Eastern Star and all that kind of weirdness. Even some of our people were in that. And so they were church people. I don't know how many of them were Christian people, God knows. But as a leader, when you have decisions to make, as David had a decision here, and you want to call the troops together, and you want to seek God's leading, you can feel kind of alone, because there was the sense much of the time that people knew what it was to pray, but somehow you weren't sure that they had a real connection with the Lord. And there was David, and he was seeking the Lord's will, and all of a sudden he's getting this backlash. It didn't matter to them that their leader, who was a most spiritual man, had gone to the Lord, and he had sought God's leading. And he said, "Let's go. The Lord has affirmed this campaign." And they said, whoa, wait, just a minute. Look, we're getting ourselves in pretty deep here. But David did something very smart, and we'd all be wise to take a lesson. Whatever venue, it's not just pastors, it's whenever we're dealing with people who are under our wing, our family, and we have arrived at a conclusion that this is the will of the Lord. You know, the chief cannot get too far out in front of the braves, as they say. The chief may be right, but it's very dangerous leadership-wise to get out ahead of the troops. So David retreated. He backed up, and he said, "All right, I understand your position. We'll double-check our headings with the Lord." Leadership often breaks down over a lack of trust. The leader may be very trustworthy. Nevertheless, if something happens, so that there is not mutual respect and so there is not mutual trust, and the leader does not appear to be on the same page as the followers, then the leadership equation will break down. And it's not because the leader is a bad person. So it's a very delicate thing, this equation of leadership. It can be broken like crystal, and then like Humpty Dumpty, it is hard to put back together again. So I marvel at David's wisdom here. He could have easily said, "What are you doing questioning me? You know I seek God's will, and the Lord has told me. I'm sure about this. Now, move out." No, he didn't. He was humble enough to go back and check. And David figured that, look, if I'm getting all of this backfire from my troops, maybe I need to do this. I would figure as a pastor, I may be, I think, confident of God's leading. But if I had an elder board that was saying, whoa, 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 just a minute, then I would probably think, look, if this is God's will, then I shouldn't have all the elder board lined up against me. So I would certainly want to go back and check my headings, as I said. My wife and I, in our relationship, she's always been with me. In this case, she is a very spiritual-minded woman. But if I think I've got God's will, and my wife, who's always been with me and ready to go and up for the action, if she's saying, Jimmy, I don't know, I don't feel good about this, trust me, I'm going to go back and I'm going to check my bearings. That's what David did here. Well, we read in verse 6 that it came about when Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, fled to David at Keilah. He came down with an ephod in his hand, which was used in determining God's direction by the priest. And when it was told Saul that David had come to Keilah, Saul said, "Ah, this is his madness again. God has delivered him into my hand." He knew that God had destined David for the throne of Israel. And yet, in his folly, he says, "God has delivered him into my hand, for he shut himself in by entering into a city with double gates and bars." And Saul, as a military man, knew that David was in not a strong position, but a weak position, closed in like that. He knew he could take him eventually by siege. So Saul summoned all the people for war to go down to Keilah and to besiege David and his men. A man opposing God is crazy enough to imagine that God is operating in his behalf. That's just how twisted a man opposing God can become, and how they can make pious excuses for the most perverse actions, immoral actions, unethical actions, and bring God in on it as if he's complicit in their perversity. Now, David knew that Saul was plotting evil against him, so he said to Abiathar the priest, "Bring the ephod here." There were the sacred lots, which David would cast, and they would determine what to do. Then David said to the Lord, "O Lord God of Israel, thy servant has heard for certain." This is not foggy intelligence. We know this for sure, that Saul is coming down here to this town to destroy the city on my account. Now I paraphrase, "I wasn't born yesterday, Lord. I know what human beings will do in situations like this, and so I need." Here David is again, getting all of his cues, getting his directions from the Lord. Will the men of this city deliver me into Saul's hand? Will Saul come down just as his servant has heard? O Lord God of Israel, I pray, tell thy servant. And the Lord said, "He will come down." Then David said, "Will the men of Keilah surrender me and my men into the hand of Saul?" And the Lord said, "That is exactly what they will do. They will surrender you." And David and his men, about 600 now, rose and departed from Keilah. And they went wherever they could go. And it was told Saul that David had escaped from the city. He gave up his pursuit. The devil likes vulnerability. And when that no longer existed, then his servant, in this case Saul, just gave up the pursuit. That's when the devil will come at us, when we're most vulnerable. And in that fortress, ironically, David was militarily vulnerable. So David stayed in the wilderness in the strongholds, and he remained in the hill country in the wilderness of Ziph. Saul sought him every day, but God did not deliver him into his hand. I go back to the people of Keilah. When they were under attack by the Philistines, David for the sake of his people, intervened. He intervened at God's direction. He carefully sought the Lord's will and had it affirmed and then reconfirmed when his men objected. And then when David delivered them, he took up residence there inside the city with walls and gates and all of that, where he felt a little more secure than roaming around on the outside with Saul, as the text says, seeking him every day. But here again, we see that David was, we would say, street smart. He understood something about human nature, and he had understood, or better to learn it, than with Saul. He understood that love and loyalty is not always returned. Certainly it was not returned with Saul, and it was not returned with Saul's servant. God had used David to deliver Saul and to save Israel from the challenge of the Philistines and from Goliath. And also in many other battles since with the Philistines. But that love and loyalty was not returned. Well, David now was a sophisticated man. He was streetwise enough to know, it's what have you done for me today? Yesterday's benefits did not matter. If the people of Keilah felt that they were going to suffer as a result of protecting David, then the Lord told David, they will hand you over. It's self-interest above your interest. That's just something that we have to understand in life. There is just a bit of wisdom. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't love people, and it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be loyal to people. We should love our friends as well as love our enemies. And we should be loyal where loyalty is due. But so many people crash and burn because in the passages of life, love and loyalty is not returned. And they just get exceedingly bitter and angry. And I understand that. If you've lived any time at all, you've probably experienced that. I remember my father-in-law, who was once a president of the local OCAW union back in my native state. He was a man of principle. And I remember on one occasion, Roy took a stand in behalf of the union. But the union at that point was not very powerful. And the stand he took got him fired, but only temporarily, I would hasten to add. But there he was, and his furniture and everything was by company goons thrown out of the house into the rain, out of the company house and into the rain. And it was a terrible time. And Roy, not a Christian at that time, looked to the right and he looked to the left for his union brothers to come forward and to stand up for him. And I remember he was forever after disillusioned, because they didn't. They were protecting their own backsides. It didn't matter what he had done for them. It didn't matter the sacrifices that he had made for them. It didn't matter the stands that he had taken for them. They were afraid of the company. And so in spite of all of that, in spite of all of that loyalty, it just didn't happen. In retrospect, I'm sure he lived long enough to realize that's the way it is. So take your stand on principle, but don't always expect it to be rewarded. I find that in the life of a pastor. You do things for people. You're there for them. But I'll tell you, don't always expect that love and that loyalty to be returned. Look at the Lord Jesus. Look at the Apostle Paul. Look at the prophets. Their love and loyalty was not always returned. That is the way life is, and that is the way people are. And when people have some self-interest, don't expect most of them to put your interest before their self-interest. For example, if you as a Christian leader or pastor, you come between people and their friends. I mean, you've been good to these people. You've been kind to these people. You've been a faithful pastor to these people. But all of a sudden, one of their friends gets sideswiped with you. They could stab you in the back just as readily as the next. Never forget the Judas complex. People will betray you. People will stab you in the back. That is life. It is not fair. But David was smart enough to know that. And so he asked in advance, Lord, will they betray me? And the Lord said, yeah, they will. And so David got out of Dodge in time. Saul sought him every day, verse 14, but the Lord did not deliver him into Saul's hands. Now David later became aware, as this ongoing flight escalates, he became aware that Saul had come out to seek his life while Saul was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. It was at this time that we see an amazing thing. Jonathan, Saul's son, arose. He had his own intelligence network, and he went to David at Horesh. Jonathan's out of Saul's favor, as we've already seen. He considers Jonathan disloyal. And he came to David, and he encouraged him in God. He said to David, "Do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul my father shall not find you, and you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you, and my father knows that also." Jonathan was wrong about "I will be next to you," but you marvel at his humility, that he was willing to accept that. So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David stayed at Horesh while Jonathan went to his house. What a model of submission to the will of God. What a model of selflessness plus faith. Oh, man, where can you find those kinds of people? But Jonathan had an affinity with David that was not based on David being an outcast, but based upon David being a man of God. That was the point of affinity. And likes tend to draw likes. So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. I take it that that covenant was a reaffirmation of the one that they made earlier. So David stayed at Horesh while Jonathan went to his house. Well, the Ziphites come to Saul at Gibeah, and they inform him that David was hiding in strongholds among them, gave him coordinates, so to speak, and they urged the king to come down with all the desire of your soul to do so. We will be complicit with you in this. We will surrender him into the king's hand. And then Saul, in his delusion and his hypocrisy, said, "May you be blessed of the Lord, for you've had compassion on me. Go now, make sure, and investigate. Gather all the intelligence you had. Get, as we would say today, get the exact coordinates. See where his place is, where his haunt is, and who has seen him there. For I'm told he's very cunning. So look and learn about all the hiding places where he hides himself. Return to me with certainty, with hard intelligence, and I will go with you, and it'll come about that if he's in the land, that I will search him out among the thousands of Judah. I'll get him." Here's an example of other misplaced loyalty. The Ziphites want to pander to Saul by helping him find and execute David. And of course, they hope by enabling him to do so that they will receive a royal reward. But any time you line up with God's enemies against God's friends, you're going to get your britches split. So they arose and went to Ziph before Saul. We read that David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon and the Arabah to the south of Jeshimon. Well, Saul and his men went down to seek him, but David got information of that. He went down to the rock and stayed in the wilderness of Maon, and when Saul heard it, well, he pursued David in the wilderness there. Saul went on one side of the mountain. David and his men were on the other side of the mountain. And David was hurrying to get away from Saul, for his men were surrounding David and his men to seize him. But then what happens? The providence of God. A messenger came to Saul and said, "Hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid on the land. While you're gone, they've taken advantage of an opening, and they're making a raid." So Saul quickly reversed himself from pursuing David, and he went down to meet the Philistines. And therefore they called that place the Rock of Escape. And David moved on from there and stayed in the strongholds of En-Gedi. Here was a divine diversion. Saul said, "You can run, David, but you cannot hide." But the Lord said, "Saul, you can seek, but you cannot find." Friends, the Lord does not always see fit to protect us life and limb. Many of his servants have died. But as long as the Lord has set his hand of protection about us, the enemy cannot have us. And if he does not set his hand of physical protection about us, it's because he's got a greater plan, for his glory and our lives are at his disposal. Well, thank you, friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.
Be sure the word. Be sure the word. Just be sure the word. gifts in the hand.